Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. Today, we continue our conversation with Canberra-based poet Paul Cliff, a poet whose writing is full of wonder. For ArtSound FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Paul Cliff is a poet, playwright, and editor. His collection, Canberra Light, from Recent Work Press in 2019, evokes the city where he has lived for more than 20 years. His A Constellation of Abnormalities, Puncher and Waltman, won the ACT Publishing Award for Poetry in 2018. Paul Cliff has also won the David Campbell Poetry Award, and his experimental play, Deadline, a manual for hostage taking, won the Canberra Playwrights Award in 2000 and was produced by Canberra Rep. He has worked as senior editor in the publications section of the National Library of Australia and the National Gallery of Australia. At the end of last week's episode, Paul Cliff read this poem, which is unusual in that it comes around to talking about how the events he evokes affected him.
King Parrot's Descent. In spring's sweet motorcade, the three fruit trees, apple, apricot, and pear, arrayed at our back fence, have dropped their crimson-white flowers like ticker tape. As a king parrot pair, leaving off the chiacking and malarkey of their high wire shenanigans, swing down onto the apple's upper branch, face off from its opposite ends, then ape walk toward each other, fist over beak over hand, to meet and playfully bump heads. Brazenly canoodle there in their savage spray can, orange and two-tone green. Their cries, too taut and perfect pealing bells, cutting my tame and flabby heart like razor wire to its cause quick.
Paul Cliff says he doesn't often refer specifically to himself in his work.
I think it can lead to boring and boringness and egocentricity. I think if the thing yourself is seeing is so powerful, and you should stand off from it and let the thing release itself, its own emanation, and it unfolds itself, and sure, it's going through your perception, but you stand outside it and just let the object talk in an almost totemic way again. This is highfalutin. Not, you know, it doesn't always work like that, but it can be something you can be aware of sometimes when writing something. That poem almost exactly happened just like that. You know, those fruit trees in our backyard, and I watched them, and then it evolved. I take a long time to write stuff, usually years. And so sometimes 20 years, or some poems in here would be 20 years old, and I put them away and pull them out again. Sometimes I only did a few things, changes.
You avoid openly using the I and the emphasis on self, and yet what comes through very strongly is that these are all observed by an unusual eye, your unusual eye, both I and I. But it's a modest eye because it's one that's looking on in wonder.
Yeah, it's appreciating what's there and letting it unfold itself. I mean, you can try and unpack it for yourself, but no, everything's pretty amazing, isn't it, really? But we're lucky to be here.
I like what you're saying, Peter, about his use of I. That makes me think of a little snippet from Antonio Machado. One of his proverbs says, an eye is not an eye because you see it. An eye is an eye because it sees you. And I think that, you know, some way echoes the way your poems work. I wonder, too, I have a real thing for birds and poetry as well in my own writing practice. I just wondered maybe if you would read the Gang Gang poem. Yeah. It has to be one of my favorite first lines. It's so funny.
The last one was a bit more lyrical in a way. This one's... Yeah, these birds also come to our backyard. All of those birds, we've got a feeding bowl and they come and we get gang gangs and galahs and all this stuff. It's great. It's what Canberra's light and native birds. It's amazing. Gang gang, emblem bird of the ACT. Evolution had a bad hair day, the day it crafted you. Trying for the galah, some say, but only partway there by the shift's end, and setting you aside on the workbench to start anew. Meantime, wily you inveigled yourself clean away. But that's all spilt milk now, and despite your undeniable shortcomings and prototypic state, poor finish and raggedy style, your blighted, unkempt topknot, untuned Greek groat call, and cockamamie Marty Feldman eye, you're quite endearing, or at least compelling, in your individual way. We've grown quite attached to you and care for you as much as the galah, some even more, today, and declare you fully fit for service in our big book of Australian birds, for sure.
In a really funny way, this poem strikes me as a love poem, you know?
I do, I love it.
And I think a lot of your poems in this book. And it's so clear when you read Canberra Light, the love that you have for this place and the things that fill the space, the place.
Yeah.
To some degree, these are love poems.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice.
Not to focus on the eye too much, but we are interested in how people come to poetry and how you did. You mentioned you've been a book editor, you've been a playwright. How does it all fit together and what's been its evolution for you?
I guess, like most people, I was pathetic enough to try writing stuff in my teens. I go through a romantic phase and that was appalling stuff like usual. What really clicked for me was I did an arts law course at Sydney Uni, and I studied Robert Lowell, and that guy just opened up everything for me. I love the tone, the real tone, the conversational thing, and he had some quite quirky stuff. His use of language, I loved that. And I said, oh, this is something that I could sort of try and work. I worked differently, but it really tapped something in me. And then other people like D.H. Lawrence, I love his, the way he does that totemic animal penetration sort of that. Thing. I love Whitman. Maybe some long line stuff came out of that. I just think Whitman's massively fantastic. I like guys like Robert Bly, who does that nature thing reduced and sort of lyrical as well. And there's a guy called James Tate, who wrote a beautiful poem called Blue Booby, which is one of my favourites. And that sort of does that thing where it's in nature but then goes to bizarre places, but it's got a lyrical intensity and moves beautifully. And and at uni I read Eliot's The Magi, Lowell's Skunk Hour, and Auden's Musée des Beaux-Arts, all three of which are among my very favourite poems. They just work beautifully in their ways.
It's interesting to hear you. For one thing, I went through this tiny little phase last week where I just read a whole bunch of James Tate poems. That's so funny because he has that brilliant way of taking you to unexpected places. He'll just have a leap and you go, and his imagination is so beautiful, you know.
He got dropped out of the later versions. I saw him in the Norton Anthology. I was amazed to get a later one, and they dropped him entirely. I couldn't believe it. I just love the Blue Booby.
Yeah, I think he's a little bit out of, I had to find him myself, even though I went through and studied poetry through, you know, 3 degrees in the U.S. I never studied Tate. Yeah. I had to find him myself, unfortunately. But it is interesting to hear you list, you know, because some of the poets you named, especially at first Lowell and Whitman, are very much I poets.
Confessional, yeah.
Yeah.
All American.
Yeah.
I love the American. They knock the poems out of the circuit in 20th century poetry, I think. They're just brilliant American.
I wondered if you would talk a little bit about what you're working on now. You say takes you a long time to finish a poem, and you sort of hinted at a little while ago that you're working on something. So what are you at work on?
Actually working on a book. Yeah, so I'm pulling. I have this huge cook pot of stuff ranging from 25 years ago to last week, and I pull stuff, and I often find that I'm obsessed with certain themes, and I try pulling those together into little sections sometimes, so I'm doing a bit of that. I've got a section which I call something like Cold, and it's got a visualization of Reykjavik and the snowies in the street, the huskies in the installed car engines in the street, and then some Antarctic stuff. So it's got connected themes like that. I'm still sorting which ones to give just for Shane.
Yeah.
And he's got his own ideas on stuff. So
a new book from Recent Work Press.
Yeah.
2024?
He tells me. I don't know if it's actually been put in an official list yet.
Well, that's something to look forward to. We asked Paul Cliff to read some more of his work.
I'll read a couple of other things which have different tone to them. So this was just a little chapbook, this one, Vanuatu Moon, published by Press, Chris Mansell. I do got a bit of travel stuff. We've done quite a bit of travel. And it's sort of biographical, but not, because I do actually use the eye a bit here as a linking device, just because we're traveling. So we're with the kids and my wife in Vanuatu, and I quite like this one, which is sort of written as prose, sort of a prose poem. I'm not sure about that distinction of prose poems and poems, you know. It works, it does, and then you can break a line or you can run it on sometimes. I heard once that Yeats actually wrote all his poems without line breaks. I don't know if that's true, but anyway. The mangrove forest in Vanuatu, the forest up here, is remarkably airy, lean and clean whenever you get into it. A terrarium of softly banded white, grey and green, light tangling like wind chimes in the glittering leaves. Tarzan grade vines, fig trees with great flying buttressy roots which you can press your hand flat to pet like a stallion's neck, and pandanus with fantail prop roofs webbing down into the sand like a witch's broom, like a teepee of driftwood caught up at its foot, great lumps of coral lolling about like old engine blocks or unfinished Greek plinths. How did they get here? Man-toted, cyclone, tsunami, king surf, or what? When you walk on the fibrous forest floor, the leaf litter trembles and gently gives like a trampoline. It's so clean you could eat your meals off it. The animal life is spare in here too. A small skink with a long blue tail. A few untroublesome spiders picked out jewel-like on their diamantine webs. Crabs must be in here, sidling off sideways too, I guess. Most surprisingly, though, no birds in this forest that we can see or hear at all. Though coming back out, we find an oyster catcher pair fossicking the limestone shore, and a reef does the odd good turn or two. Gulls don't like atolls, we are later told, if it's true. Yes, the forest of Vanuatu is a beautiful and salubrious thing, capacious, well-lit, with occasional high-hung gentle creek shift, like a colder mobile sculpture overhead, champion lean and sinewy, entrancing to move yourself through, and with a feel of probity and righteousness almost, of taking and giving no more than its need and its due, of doing everything honourably and true, seeming church-like with its green vine scaffolding tangling the naves and the sky showing through like a stained glass window pane. I'd like to be the verger here if they'd let me have the key. All this is as seen by daylight, at least. I'm not sure what the night might do.
It reads a little bit like almost like a well-composed diary entry, like a travel diary.
It's sort of edges on it, the whole structure. But you heighten the language. And,
yes.
So it sort of falls between, I call it a prose poem sequence, and got criticised in a review saying it was a travel log, which I can sort of argue, but some poems you could pull out separately, like I think that's one, and another funny one I might just read.
Yeah.
For the sake of,
can you just say to again the publisher and what year it came out?
This is Vanuatu Moon. It was published in two books, pocket size. The idea was, or the publisher was, it could go in your pocket and it's cheap to post. And she just, Chris Mansell, she's a well-known Australian poet, and it's just stapled down the front, and she just produces it in her house down in Berry on the south coast. This is a more humorous one. about a cat. We had 2 days in this luxury resort for the heck of it, you know. The other times we were in more humble accommodation, and we turned up and were presented with coconut cocktails and all this rubbish and that. But anyway, we're in this great place with a king size bed, and this cat turned up, a cat called Pamplemousse, which, as the poem says, is the French word for grapefruit. A cat called Pamplemousse. There's a break-in at our bungalow that night when a small, fine-boned marmalade cat, female, in a faux jewel powder blue collar, saunters in through the open French doors and jumps to curl up unfussed on the end of our king-sized bed, a privilege she's evidently accustomed to. She's so fine and light-boned that when you pick her up, it's like taking a warm sock from the dryer. The girls call her Pamplemousse, after the lovely local word for grapefruit. Pamplemousse, she somehow rightly seems, and for the balance of our 2 day stay anyway, Pamplemousse she remains, either sleeping curled up in our veranda hammock by daylight, or on the end of our king-size bed by night.
That reviewer's comment is a strange one, really, when you think about it. It would sort of seem to argue that there's poems, there's prose poems, there's travelogue, and Never the Twain Would Meet. What you've read is clearly not just travelogue, because there's an interpretation and an investment of observation in it. That those are the qualities of poetry. So whether it's one of those categories or another one, who cares?
The other thing, too, is that it is, in fact, the 21st century and hybridity, right? Taking from one form and interweaving it into another. It works.
I'm actually doing another one on East Timor, so that's nice to hear. Mm. So.
You mentioned that you like to travel, and in a sense you're a traveller to Canberra who's been here a long time now. You still sort of see what's novel and striking and revealing about it. But what for you is travel? Is it an opportunity to have that capacity in you activated?
Yeah, it certainly is an important part of what I get off on when I'm travelling. But I just love travel. Just love the freedom of it. You just leave everything there and you're in someone else's reality. You go to India or something like that and you're just overwhelmed. You're in their place. This again comes back to that idea of place. Just astonishing sights everywhere. You're exhausted after 6 weeks of travelling around. You know, it's amazing. So it's new perception on steroids, you know, to travel to some, well, most places really. Even going, I wrote also about travelling in Western New South Wales and Queensland, and I wrote this new book I'm working on. There's one about crocodiles, because crocodiles just so in your head when you go to Queensland. That's what's different about Canberra. I didn't see a croc in Lake Burley Griffin, I don't think. But, you know, the idea of suddenly you get to a certain point and you don't really swim there. They've got all these magnificent pools and cans and stuff, because you can't go in the water out there. And I grew up in the northern beaches in Sydney. We're just on the beach all the time. So it turns your head around to be in this different space like that. So you look at that space and see the other things that it offers.
Here are some poems from his first book from 1994.
This is my first book, The Wolf Problem in Australia. And I'd like to acknowledge Ron Preddy, who's one of the great figures in Australian poetry in the 20th century, set up this thing called New Poets series. We did like 10 or so of them, I think, and huge numbers of people got their first book. I'll just read some of the ones here, like Lauren Williams, Stephen Herrick, Richard Allen, Jill Jones, Kevin Brophy, Jennifer Compton, Carolyn Gerrish, Andy Kassane. I was in the second series of that, and they were very small productions, and again, just stapled 32 pages of poems. And I think this is my first book, not published till I was 41, I think. So pretty late before. And again, some of these I've probably had for 10 years. But I'd read the title poem because it's something I do. One of the things I do is I sort of do fractured fables where I take some historical thing and I turn it around and come at it in a bizarre way to sort of come in the back door of an issue or something. I'll read the title poem, The Wolf Problem in Australia, which I subtitle An Historical Romance. When the sharks came, the wolves left the water, huddling on the beaches, fleeing naked to the suburbs, some taking domestic work as dogs, cf. Canis familiaris, inbreeding with poodles and chihuahuas, overturning garbage bins, and occasionally savaging small children, cf. Doberman, Alsatian. Others, too long in the tooth, retired to the backwoods stroke Tasmania, creating some confusion, cf. Tas, Devil, Tiger. The last mainland sighting being a full-blooded male departing a North Sydney boarding house around the time of, say, Petrov or the Shark Arm case, when the post-war immigration boom of the 50s saw the first wave of Aboriginals enter the country under the auspices of a federal government seeking unskilled labour. CF, Fiji, Moree, Yarraba, Noonkumba, Redfern, Tumala, the Alice, Wilcannia.
Have you read much Southwest literature from the United States? I'm thinking like Terry Tempest Williams has her book Red, and Red is definitely a hybrid work.
Hey.
But she does so much with listing place names and naming things, and they're becoming incantations of sorts.
That's what they are.
Yeah.
It's like you name something, it becomes real. Sort of.
Yeah.
Almost like the, you know, cave paint the bison and it's there, it's real. The guys can go out and hunt it and kill it and get the meat.
Right.
It's like it's about emanation
yeah.
coming into being.
Yeah, yeah. That poem is, again, from The Wolf Problem in Australia, 1994, in the New Poet series that the late Ron Pretty published through his Five Islands Press.
I should do a cheer out to the poetry publishers. They're heroes. And Ron Pretty, Shane here in Canberra, and David Musgrave of Puncher and Wattman. These people, yeah, we wouldn't have voices, we wouldn't appear anywhere. The other person that operates like that is Jeff Page in Canberra. They're just energy forces and give people opportunities, and it's often a pretty hard life, and they're fitting it in with lots of other stuff and never making any money out of it. So, yeah, Shane Strange, if I mean. Yeah. This one is from The Impatient World, which came out in 2002, Five Islands Press again, so it followed on that one a few years later, quite a few years later. I'll read a slightly longer one again, but it's in a narrative. This is based on a real story I heard. I used to work at Darlinghurst Social Security Office in Sydney, and before I got into publishing, and a guy I met told me this and used the nuts of his story, and then I played with it like I often do. I pulled it out and brought in some bizarro effects and stuff. It's called Walking Boots, The Long March, story with optional romantic ending. She'd seduced him to a Flinders farm, self-sufficiency of maize and oats, a goat, organic fruit and veg, baking their own bread, the expertise hers, the learning curve mostly his, buying him Blundstone working boots as training wheels to stumble his clumsy waltz with the breathing earth. 6 months down, he dropped his guard and turned his head away one day, looked back and found that it apparently had ended. Farewells conducted without recrimination, the smell of bridges which perhaps could be unburned, a final gentle hug on the bull-nosed veranda. Then, tickling the kelpie's ear, he'd slung his things in the ute one long blue Flinders Sunday afternoon and left. Sydney, 4 weeks later. Still serving the statutory period of bewilderment and hurt, subsisting now on factory work, he returned from a shift to discover the gift of a post-pack at his front door. Postmarked, will pen a pound, surface mailed a week before, her sure round slightly crazed imprimatur upon it. Inside he unfumbled the nuzzling weight of his work boots. He slung them on the kitchen table, tore open a beer, then frowning, pawed the Guinness Book of Records, and finally adjudged the only comparable homing feat to be an 1,100-kilometre walk by a cat named Geronimo from Wisconsin to Idaho in 1968, though that had been through snow, not Australian high summer. Optional ending, romantic. Stapled cleanly through the right boot's tongue, this note. The tap's leaking again and the bed hurts. The goat is playing up at school. Won't you please climb in and steer us home? Yours truly, Bungling Blunderstones.
I love the optional ending. That's, no, really, it's an interesting way to end a poem.
I like the idea of romance and sentimentality too. Like, they're powerful and strong and valid, some of a romance more so, but sentimentality too has a place. And you can write a good sentimental poem, which sort of rejuvenates the idea of what is classified as sentimental. It's gone into it's got bad odor now, but we're all sentimental at various times. I read one. This is about my youngest child up in Armidale when we were living in the New England tableland. It's a short one, but it's in her voice. One of the things I do is I use monologue quite a bit. And so this one is this breathless thing which she came home from school, and it's almost directly what she said. I'll just have to explain a couple of specific things probably. I talk about a red ribbon which was given to the kids who were picked out for the day as good, and they were the ones that walked with the kids to the school crossing or something. So they wore this diagonal red sash. There's a reference to a guy called Selmeg, Mongolian. It's spelt T-S-E-L-M-E-G, so that's why it refers to the letter T. And they got kinder yellow, blue and red, which were colours for just designating the different kindergartens. So this is called Mongolia Connection for Armidale City Public School. Hey Dad, guess which two kids got the red ribbon today? Listen, here's a clue. One starts with T, the other starts with A. Give up, okay? Well, A is Alice, my best friend, and T, it's Selmeg. Selmeg's new. He comes from Mongolia. There's not many Mongolia kids at Armidale School, Mrs. Melville says. We're lucky that we got him. There's no other Mongolia kids in kinder yellow, kinder blue, only kinder red. But kinder yellow's got two kids from Ethiopia. That's Africa, Sophie says. It's true. Well, this is the last one I picked out. It was my favourite poems of what I got. This one's more lyrical. This was, again, an impatient world. It's called Kelp Forest Annunciative. World's tallest kelp grows to 200 metres, moored just off the Californian coast. Taller than all its onshore air-breathing cousin redwoods. Each plant slow marches on the spot, upright as shocked hair. Each copse tight-reined, tides jockey through it. Hectare upon hectare, like great wavering brown drowned library stacks of words, woven from all languages and tongues of the world's lovers, all written, spoken forms, pillow talk, postcard, assignation note, email, ghazal and madrigal, rock lyric, ballad, sonnet, ode. The kelp stands listening, absorbing all of this unto itself in its still anchored, ululating herd, awaiting its critical mass till the expression is perfect and love's finally got the right words, at which each plant, detaching its root foot, will effortlessly rise to headbutt the sunlit surface, and all will be uttered to the impatient world.
On this week's episode of Poetry on the Radio, as on last week's, our guest has been Canberra-based poet Paul Cliff. Next week and the week after, we'll air two episodes marking the first anniversary of broadcasts of Poetry on the Radio. We, the hosts and producers of the program, will read some of the poems that led us to become devotees of poetry. For Artsound FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded traditional land in the studios of ArtSound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan.